You know, it's always a difficult position to be in, to be asked to speak about a topic that people are often generally under the impression that they already know what you're going to say. So when Rabbi Loike comes in to speak about birds, so he's at a major advantage because he knows that there's no one in the room that's going to be able to carry on much of a conversation with him in terms of what he knows in the Messiah and the Torah behind birds. But the truth is that to know kosher fish doesn't take very long, and hopefully, you know, if I'm still doing this 10 years from now, my audience will have heard it already in elementary school, and they'll already know what I have to say now, and it'll just be a more adult version. But I was thinking on the way over, by my Rebbe, who was once asked to speak by, I think it was Harvard University, about Judaism. So he walked into a room full of people who were mostly under the impression that they already know all about being Jewish. So he realized he isn't going to get very far unless he makes sure to nip that one in the bud and get the audience's attention. So here's what he did. He went in, he introduced himself, and he asked of the audience members present, who here thinks he knows about Judaism? And of course, everyone raised their hand dutifully. Yes, yes, I'm a Jew, I know all about being Jewish. Fine. And how many people here are more familiar with their Judaism than, say, Catholicism? So obviously, you know, people raise their hand. Of course, you know, I'm a Jew, I know all about being Jewish. Hit me. Okay. What was the name of Moses' mother? Raise your hand. Okay. And what was the name of Jesus' mother? And you'll imagine that most of the people present were more familiar with the answer to the latter than to the former. Then he asked, okay, who here knows what day Jesus was born? Raise your hand. And everyone raise their hand. And who here knows which day Moses was born? Raise your hand. And there wasn't a whole lot of answers. So everybody proceeded to say, I just want to go back to the first question. Who here knows more about Judaism than he does about Catholicism? Raise your hand. And then no hands went up. Good, good. Now that we're all on the same page, now I have what to tell you. So Rabbi Loike told me that I don't have to try that one over here, that Baruch Hashem, we have a receptive audience, and I don't have to worry about too many barbs coming my way in the process of trying to tell you what I know about kosher fish. But we'd like to start at the beginning. You know, the first thing they taught us in high school speech and debate class was that if you're going to make a speech, you have to sign point your terms. You can't start blapping with a term and not make sure that your entire audience is on the same page with you what the term is. So if I'm going to sit here and speak about kosher fish, we have to first agree to the definition of kosher fish. So are there any volunteers? Somebody would like to tell us what the definition of a kosher fish is? Yes?
It has scales that you can peel off.
It has scales that you can peel off. Okay. That's it?
Fins.
Okay. The most popular initial reaction is to be told that kosher fish have fins and scales, to which my response is that is false. Fins and scales have nothing to do with the kashrus of a fish. So those of you who like to paskin their Yoredei Shailas out of an article chumash are out of luck. So you thought, you opened up right there in the middle of a Yikra Yirah with Pasuk Tes, kosher fish equals fins and scales, close the chumash and get straight to the fish store, you're in big trouble. Because fins and scales have nothing to do with kosher fish. And why is that? Because the term scale, at least, as far as it's used in terms of the dictionary definition of a scale, doesn't have all that much to do with the Torah's terms for kosher fish, which of course is snapir v'kaskasas. Okay. Now the Gemara happens to be in Chulin Sama Vav, basically, isn't so sure exactly which is which. It's pretty clear the Gemara never had a question that together snapir v'kaskasas referred to fins and scales. Well, I wasn't sure which one was which right away. So the Gemara goes to the back and forth and comes to the conclusion that snapir refers to the fin which the fish uses to swim with, and that the kaskasas refers to the discs along the side of the fish's body. Lisa learns from a pasuk in Navi that somebody was referred to as wearing a coat of mail, and that was described as kaskasas. So they learned that the kaskasas on the fish must be similar to kaskasas of a coat of mail, so those little discs that kind of protect you from, you know, the errant sword along the battlefield are good for protecting the fish against the errant predator through the battlefield of the ocean. And the Gemara concludes that you needed to have snapper kaskasas, But then the Gemara makes a surprising statement that really there's no need for us to discuss snapir at all, because everything that has kashkashas has snapir. So right away, 50% of what was written in the pasuk you can put on the side, because it's not really no gale maisa. We will not discuss fins much if at all for the rest of our conversation, because fins have very little to do with the kosher status of a fish. There are certain times it actually did come up that there was a question about something benogea to having fins. But Chazal already tells us, kol sheyesh by kaskesh yesh by snapir. So we can take the rabbi's word on it, and we're done with snapir at this point. So now we're down to kaskesh, and the question, of course, is going to be, what is kaskesh? And I just told you it's not a scale. Yes?
Do you find that to be true, practically, that everything that has kaskesh has snapir?
Yes. Yeah. If I managed to disprove Chazal, you wouldn't be hearing it for the first time here at Lander College. If I had a paper to write showing that I proved somebody major wrong, there was one point, just so you know, we had one to discuss. There was a question in the office. The Beis Yosef makes a statement in Yeridea Pei Gimel Chaf Zion. The Shach makes a statement, I'm sorry, I quote the Beis Yosef. The Shach quotes the Beis Yosef saying by Kirvei Dogim, by fish eggs, that they had he has a Masorah from the Kadmoinim that all red eggs come from kosher fish, and that there's no such thing as a red egg that comes from a non-kosher fish. And if you'll find a red egg from a non-kosher fish and you salt it, it turns black. The Pri Chadash and the Aruch HaShulchan and others take serious issue with such a statement. The fact that we find no Masorah for such a thing. The Beis Yosef doesn't even quote in somebody's name so much as Kadmoinim, whoever those Kadmoinim are, that it has to be that such a thing is true. And there are some Orim on this afterwards. So there was one Tekufa when I was young and insolent, and I decided to look into whether the Beis Yosef was right or not. And we tried to come up with different kinds of fish roe that were red but not kosher. And so far the Beis Yosef stands. So much I could tell you. There was a question somebody asked before about fish that would potentially be a shiloh sakana. There's a shiloh in the Rush. He brings it in the Tosis Yontiv on this Gemara. It's not for Kaskesis and Chulin. Then the third parak. The Gemara brings over the Tosis Yontiv, not Tosis Yontiv, the Madonna Yontiv underneath the Rush, brings a Maisa from a certain doctor, the Reifer Rebbe of Rum, who asked, you know what I'm talking about? He brings Maisa from the Reifer Rebbe of Rum, who asked the following question. There's a certain fish called Stinkus Marinus, which happens to be, it's not really a fish anyways, but put that aside for a minute. There's a fish called Stinkus Marinus that has kaskesh and does not have snapir. And it swims in the Yam Sfarad, and it's Sama Mavus Loichlel. That's what he said. So he has a two-part question. One, what do you do with this chazal, kol sheyesh bo kaskesh, yesh bo snapir? And two, what do you do with the fact that we know Darcheh Darchinayim, and that how could it be that the Torah should be matter to us a fish that if we'll follow the simon of a fourth batayra, we'll come to eat something and drop dead from it? Okay, so the second question, the Madani Yantiv was not concerned with akiuze. Because Mehech Teisa that you have a right to eat whatever you want just because technically it meets the rules. Lamashal. This fish on the table, let's say for a moment that it's kosher fish, yeah? So if it's kosher fish but you leave it on the table for 2 weeks and then you come back and try to eat it, you may very well get sick from it. You followed all the rules. It even has Ashkacha tape on it. V'loyoyten, it has a simon kosuv b'Torah. It has a simon kosuv by Rabbi Beck, right there across the back of the thing. But if you eat it, you might get sick and die. But that's not God's fault, because you're expected to know the rules of how to be a human being in addition to the rules of knowing how to be a yid. So the fact that something could potentially be a sakana to eat and have the kosher simonim is not betz mistir. But the first question of this fish potentially having snapir, kaskeses, and no snapir, that was a big tumult. And it wasn't just a tumult in the Madani Yantav, but it seems like basically every Acheron in that Tekufa had to put in his two cents of how he answered up this question. The crazy is, if you look in the Encyclopedia Talmudis, on Dogim at the beginning, he goes through this clear, and he'll give you a whole list of Marah Makaymas of all the different, who weighed in and what was their tzad on it. So the Madani Yantav says the Deichik at first that it must be that it was a murka of Miachar HaSinai. That they mutated two different species in order to create such a thing. And then he says that, for example, some people say that the Torah only said roiv, and roiv is a machriya when you don't have anything else, but if you know that this is an exception to the roiv, if you find an animal that's treif, you don't say, it must be I'm wrong, you're not really treif, because roiv behemish kteris. So the fact that my eyes are telling me that you're treif can't be, so it must be, I have to answer it up somehow. Rav is a rule until you'll know otherwise. You'll know otherwise, you put the rule aside. Some people say that the legs on this thing are in fact snappier. That was another way to answer the question. And some people say the snapper fell off. I mean, there was a lot. Every theoretical answer you could give was offered by somebody. At least everyone that I thought of, the second view of Talmudus brings from somebody that somebody suggested such an answer. But so far we haven't found a real exception, especially since when we found out what the Stinkus marinus is, it's clearly a lizard and not a fish. So there's a question about that. Bechlal, if the simon of Torah is on anything that you find in the sea, or if it has to dafke have tzura sadag or not, that's also machlekes rishayim. We've had to learn if dog has to have a specific tzura or not. If be'etem, not having a tzura dog, makes it a sheret hayam, that means even if it has all the simonim, but it's a sheret hayam that has snapper kaskas, it's not a rye. Okay, so let's put that aside. Your question was only if we ever found something. The long answer was no.
Well, let's run the topic. The Gemara speaks about Rosh Hashanah
Shedra. We're not going to discuss Rosh Hashanah. I'll never get through with what I have on the table, let alone with Rosh Hashanah. It's machlekes rishonim. If we even said it la'alacha in the end. It sounds like we did. The Torah quotes from Yudah Chassid saying it la'alacha, and I don't know. I can definitely tell you examples of fish, like the Gemara said, that we have examples of fish that are Rosh Hashanah, but it's kosher. There is no kosher fish that I know of that doesn't have chuta shedra. That much I can tell you. I never heard of one. I never heard of a kosher fish that doesn't have chuta shedra. But there are fish. There are definitely fish with pointy noses. There's no question about that. A nice Yiddish shnaz that goes out like that. No question. Sailfish. The Tzitz Eliezer quotes about sailfish. You ever heard of sailfish? Okay, if you're from Florida, you know what sailfish is. Sailfish, marlin is another one. There's a question from the Beis Knesset Gedolah if that's called Karavadag or not, which is the fish called Karavadag when they were trying to mount the swordfish. That was one of the clads they had. So yeah, in Echanami, they're fish that definitely have pointy noses that are, heads like that, and it's kosher. Okay, so now, we got rid of snapier, and we're down to kaskasis. And I told you that kaskasis is not scales. Kaskasis is not scales, and the reason is because not all scales fit into the definition of kaskasis. All kaskasis will be scales, but not all scales are kaskasis. What do I mean? There are scales which are not kaskasis. For example, sharks have scales. Sharks have, I believe, gadoid scales. Gadoid scales are a very interesting barrier. It's a scale that has ganoin on the top and dentine in the middle. I don't know, I don't remember all the biology behind it. But basically, it's made out of several different layers, and there's a peg joint inside between one and the other, and the scales are basically all connected, one to the other and to the fish, which makes the shark very sharp when you'll whack into him. You know, somebody talked about shark attack, and it felt like he was hit by sandpaper. You ever seen reports like that? So that's the scales. The gadoid scales on the shark scratch the person because they actually have points that come out of them. But those scales can't be removed without ripping the skin, and those scales are not kaskasis. So you mentioned before, the definition of kosher fish, and we'll prove to you where I get this from, is fish who have scales that can be removed without ripping skin. Where you get such a thing from? The Ramban says it in Chumash, and that pasuk Vayikra Yud Aleph test. The Ramban says kaskasis have to dafke be niklat biyad v'sakim glikriyasa or. Okay, no question on that. And even though it's a funny thing that the first place it's found in the Ramban and Chumash, the Ramah doesn't bring it from the Ramban and Chumash, believe it or not. The Ramah brings it down from, I forgot, one of the nice that came on the Rambam, I think. But the first place that I've ever heard of it brought is the Ramban, and Urbasakin, or with a knife, without ripping the skin. And that is a simon mefurish b'Torah. You do not need a mesorah on that. And unlike your whole shmiel on birds, which is a whole question of tzeyer mesorah, tzeyer mesorah, there's no mesorah issues over here. Well, I shouldn't say that. There's almost no questions of mesorah over here. Well, every rule has its exception. And if you'll find a rule that doesn't have an exception, it's also an exception to the rule. So the bottom line is, the rule is that there's basically no such din as Masaira by fish at all. But of course there's going to be exceptions to that where it doesn't come up. But there's no din Masaira, because it's Simon Mufush B'Torah, and there's I think it's Tur Zichron Yehuda. I think it's from the Sum of the Rush. So somebody asked him the question. It's a very funny, flowery wording. The Shoyo asked the question, Rebbe, please teach us, Rebbe, be Muhammad us, over and over again, the same thing. And basically he just said, we have a certain fish, I found scales on it, what do you want from me? To the which the answer was, what do you want from me? It's a fish, but if it has scales, ask us into hate. So that's basically where we learned it from. And as far as I know, Lefman de Pollig, everybody agrees, if it has scales that can be removed without ripping the skin, it's kosher fish. Now, there's a question sometimes, if a fish has scales, that can be ruined without ripping the skin? That's a question. That's a very popular question. For example, those of you who want to ask about swordfish, which I'm not going to talk about other than this, will find that one of the hakiras about swordfish is if it has scales, which can be removed without ripping the skin, and that maybe the reason why we don't find them is because they fell out already or because they were reabsorbed back into the fish. Those kind of things are questions which can lead to the question of whether something is a kosher fish or not. Okay, there's another fish that had there was a question about it. I'll say it's the kingclip. You might have heard something that people write about it. The question on kingclip was whether the scales on the side of a kingclip are considered kaskasis or not, because they're very soft. They're much, much softer and thinner than the scales you would find on any other fish. And when you take them out of the fish, they're actually wet. They're wet. They pull out. They're very soft. They're completely pliable. And only when you'll pull them out and let them dry do they kind of look like a traditional scale. So that was another major hakira, and the people who are chaker on the kingclip, that's the basis of the question. Is that shaped thing called a scale or not? Okay? If it has scales that can be removed from the fish without ripping the skin, it's a kosher fish. That's it.
Scales covering just any part of the fish?
One scale anywhere on the body. There's a Tosefta that talks about three places. Behind the gills, by the fin, which we assume is the dorsal fin. So I say that we say fin. You know, everyone thinks that fish, of course that fish have fins. Let me show you how many fins are on a tilapia. There's a dorsal fin over the back. There are what they call pectoral fins, the flappy army kind of fins, right? There are the, there's the anal fin, the tail fin, and I forgot what the fin is called under here. There's another one, Durton. Okay, so now on the tilapia alone, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and some people have a second dorsal fin, which technically has a second in. So now you have 6 different fins somewhere along the body of the fish, not including the other side pectoral fin, right? So now you're talking 7. So there's 7 different fins you could potentially have on the fish, and no one talks about it. Why? Because I just told you, it's not nogela maisa, so why should anybody bother discussing which fin is the one that's officially called the fin? So there is one nafkamina that I found so far, at least, and that is the Tosefta that says that you're supposed to check 3 places for a scale. You're supposed to check behind the gills over here. I'm saying over here. You're going to record this and you're going to say over here. So I'm talking over here is behind the gill, okay? That over here, not the other over here, okay? Then one is along the fin, which we're assuming is the dorsal fin, yeah? And the third is by the anal fin, the tail fin, okay? Not the anal fin, the tail fin. Over here, and the reason is very practical. Anybody here practical? Practical anyone?
Those are all far apart, so you can always.
The far part end.
So we get chopped, and you only get part of it. Always.
That's a good try. That was a very practical response, but they have a different reason. That there's a the thing toilet shocking toilet and toilet strainer. That what happens is if this tilapia was unlucky enough to share a space in the fish department next to somebody that wasn't so kosher, he could shed a scale and it might land on the fellow next door. So you'll go to check it for scale, you'll find a scale right there. So yes, it is a scale. But if you'll check these 3 places, it's very unlikely that that scale is going to come from another fish, because most likely when something gets, when one fish mishes another, they mish around here in the middle of the body. So if you find scale in the middle of the body and it's definitely from this fish, it's not a problem. But if you're not so sure, the best place to look is here, here, and here. Okay? I love speaking about fish, because what am I afraid someone's going to throw at me something? I can throw it right back. So it happens like this. So basically, you're stuck at this point with, this is the din. Bottom line, if it has a scale, you can be removed without ripping the skin, you're good. Okay, so I can really pack up and go home now, right? Because you basically heard the spiel. But you still have some questions. Because the first thing you want to know is, okay, that's what the definition of a kosher fish. So we defined a kosher fish, that's very good. Now I'd like to go shopping. So what do you suggest, Eric Goldberg? So here's some popular but wrong suggestions of what people like to do when they go to have a kosher fish, they say. They call up Rabbi Goldberg at the OU. Hello, Rabbi Goldberg. Yes. I heard the OU has a list of kosher fish. Huh? Yeah, years ago the OU put out a list of kosher fish, and I'd like to go shopping, so if you wouldn't be so kind and fax it over to me, I've got 15 minutes before I have to be at the fish store, so you fax me the list of kosher fish and then I will go shopping for kosher fish. And then I have to explain to the fellow, no, you don't understand, it doesn't work like that. I'm going to give you a list of kosher fish, and you're not going to be able to do anything with it. And the guy says, Rabbi Goldberg, why not? And I say to him, because how do you know that the fish that's listed on my list is going to be the fish behind your fish counter? And I actually had a mice like this once. A fellow called me. Baruch Hashem, it was not an OU supermarket. But a fellow called me up, Mashkiach. He works in the fish department of so-and-so supermarket and so-and-so state. And he wants to know from me if tilapia is a kosher fish. So be it though I'm working at the OU now for a while, I didn't answer him so fast, but I first wanted to know. I'm just curious, why do you want to know? And he said, well, you know, I'm working here at the fish counter, here at, you know, so-and-so supermarket, and they got in a box of tilapia, and I want to know if I can put it with the kosher fish. It's a perfectly reasonable question, right? So, but the guy at the OU is not such a reasonable guy, so I still don't want to answer him. So I said, so what are you calling me for? So open up the box and see if it looks like this, and you pull a scale off of it, so then what do you want from me? You have a scale. Oh, Rabbi Goldberg, you don't understand. It doesn't have any scales on it anymore. I said, okay, well, what does the skin look like? No, Rabbi Goldberg, it doesn't have any skin on it either. That's why I'm calling you, because I want to know if tilapia is a kosher fish. I can't tell myself if it's kosher. I need you to tell me if it's kosher. And I said to the fellow, and how do you know that it's tilapia? Because the box says tilapia? Because after all, if it says tilapia on the box, what are they going to put inside of there? Something besides tilapia? Right? It's a reasonable thing, right? Except if you open a newspaper. And if you open up a newspaper recently, so you may well have heard of one of the myriad means a lot, a myriad lawsuits currently going on where the government is suing fishmongers. Fishmonger, by the way, is a term that you use to insult somebody when you can't say your mother was army boots, you call them a fishmonger. Why? Because it describes somebody as being the worst kind of trying to get away with something when everyone's not looking kind of fellow. So, they are suing a fishmonger. What did this fishmonger do? First, we have to get back and discuss some politics. Because, you know, you can't discuss good fish without politics. You understood? Here's what happened. For many, many years, there were fish farmers in a place called Vietnam that were selling a very delicious fish called bassa. They were selling it to the U.S. and they were calling it catfish. You know why? Because it looks exactly like catfish. If you would look at this fish, you'd be ready to say that this is catfish. But there's a very big problem with this bassa catfish, because it's a lot cheaper than American catfish. Well, they were selling it to the U.S., and believe it or not, when restaurants and caterers and food service people had the choice between Vietnamese bassa catfish and American southern catfish at twice the price of the Vietnamese product, they were going for the Vietnamese stuff that was much cheaper and tasted exactly the same. Could you imagine that happening, yes or no?
Yeah.
Lots of nodding heads, that's a good thing. College boys, good. So now, when you have a cheaper product and a more expensive product and you don't know the difference, obviously you're going to buy the cheaper product, and that's what happened. So the southern catfish farmers walk up there into Congress. Mr. Congressman, I have something I'd like to discuss with you. What's that? You'd like me to donate to your campaign next year? Yes, I would. Good. Then I'd like to tell you about my problem. There are these guys from Vietnam that are selling fish and undercutting me, gefährlich, and I can't make a parnassa anymore. So what you're going to have to do is fix it. And this congressman says, I would love to fix it. I really would. What would you like me to do to fix it? And like all good lobbyists, he gave the exact right answer. What I need you to do is make that the legal definition of catfish is only and nothing other than the catfish that I make. That way we define the term, in the United States you can't sell this catfish unless it's my catfish. Everyone's on the same page? Good. So what we do is we find a great transportation bill, and when no one's looking, we, you know, pick it up, shove some pork earmark in there, shut it down, the president signs at the bottom, tells everybody they're getting an extra $20 in their paycheck, and boom, I'm covered. I now have my catfish be the only thing in the United States legally allowed to be sold as catfish. So you say, what does that have to do with kosher? I'm like, Goldberg, catfish is not kosher. Yeah, you wanted to say that, right? I cut you off because you were just about to say that. Okay. So I'll tell you what it has to do with kosher. Because the guy selling bassa, they were now stuck. So what are they supposed to do with all this beautiful farm fish? You know, you can't just flip a bassa farm and turn it into something else with a snap of the fingers. So what are the guys supposed to do? So they said, okay, you can sell it to the U.S., but you're going to have to pay a 40% duty. So the guy starts doing the math. If I raise my price, I have to cover a 40% duty, then I'm not going to make any money anymore because now the southern catfish is going to be better at the same price and better quality and the name recognition, and now he can't, the guy who gets it, not able to sell his catfish, now I'm mamish up a creek. So he goes back to Vietnam, he's scratching his head trying to figure out what he's going to do. And then the light bulb goes off. Why do I have to tell everybody that it's bassa and pay a 40% duty on importing to the United States? I'll give it a new name. Why, I'll call it grouper. You know where I thought of that name from? Because it's a delicious kosher fish that people sell in Florida, and the guys in Florida are paying a belt of money for that grouper. I'll call my bassa grouper, and I'll sell it to them for the same price that I'm selling bassa for. So, the guy starts baking up his boxes. He got a beautiful picture of a grouper, a smiley face grouper right on the side of the box, prints it all up, fills it up with bassa, which looks nothing like grouper, by the way. Not even remotely close. But, fills it up with boxes, ships it to the United States, and now there's a buyer from a beautiful white tablecloth, you know, fancy place, restaurant, you know, like, Shay, you can't afford this, right? So the chef from Shay, you can't afford this, goes into the fish market and he sees two boxes in front of him. He sees the box of grouper at $15 a pound, and he sees a box of Vietnamese grouper for $2 a pound. And he starts shaking his French head, and he's thinking, something is not right over here. But he comes to the conclusion that I'm going to buy the $2 a pound grouper, because what am I, stupid? I'm going to buy it for $2 a pound and sell it for 50 bucks a plate, and I'll make myself a nice parnassa. And you'll think that there's one nut job who decided to do that, but I'm sorry to tell you. Recently, there was a group of high school students in Florida that decided to do a little genetic testing. And instead of classmates, they went to the grouper restaurant. Not just the white tablecloth, fancy, hoity-toity places. They went to the fish shacks, and everybody up and down the financial spectrum. In Florida, grouper is like mayonnaise. You find it everywhere, right? The whole range of restaurants, somebody's selling grouper. The cheap places fry and serve with french fries. The fancy, you guys put it on a plate with some pasta you can't pronounce and charge 50 bucks a plate for it. Whatever it is, yeah? So they decided to go to each of these restaurants, get a little sample of grouper, bring it back to their lab, do their little testing, write their science fair project, and they found out that 90% of the grouper sold in the state of Florida was basa. How did the guy get away with it? Because nobody wanted to know that what he was buying wasn't grouper. Because it was a lot cheaper to get this. Everybody wins. The guy in Vietnam wins because he's able to sell his fish. The guy at the fruit store or the fish store that's selling the stuff, he doesn't know. He's making better money on the grouper that's basa because that more of that's moving than the stuff that's really. And the guy at the restaurant wins because now when he sells it, he paid a lot less for the same fish and he keeps it. The only one who gets messed up is the consumer. So who's fighting for the consumer? That would be your friends at the Food and Drug Administration. Well, the Food and Drug Administration back in 1992, I believe, put an article up on its website. You can still check it now. It's Something Fishy, I think is the name of the article. I think it was June 1992 or 95, I'm not sure. It's something fishy going on over here. And within the FDA rights, by the way, you should know, don't rely on us when it comes to species integrity because we're really not on the ball at all. And when somebody gets up and writes on their website in big, bold, capital letters, I'm not checking for this, what do you think is the likelihood that he's checking for it? Zero. Anybody? Zero! Correct. Close. The FDA says, listen, we try. But listen, there's three of us and 50,000 of them. So what do you think is going to happen? So what does the FDA recommend? Go to someone you trust. Okay? We basically step back into the 1700s where you're on your own, Tuts, because the FDA is going to be defending you and nobody's actually watching these guys until one of his competitors decides that he's going to put him out of business and then turns him into the FDA. And that happens all the time. Which is when you hear about lawsuits. The guy got knocked $50,000 and he's in the jail for a while because he got caught with, you know, some amount of product. So you'll say, Rabbi Goldberg, so how frequently is this happening? Frequently. Follow the newspaper, you'll see it happens more regularly than it should. So, guy can tell the difference, can't he? I would have thought the guy could tell the difference, especially the guy at, you know, the fancy places. He's paying good money for the stuff. He should know, couldn't tell the difference. Now, so you'll say, it should be radically different, right? Does anyone know what fish this is? Any fish experts over here?
Flounder.
Flounder, any other? Plankton, what? I'd say flounder going once, flounder going twice. Flounder, everyone's sure it's flounder? Flounder. Okay. And this.
Salmon.
Chicken. Okay, anyone who doesn't have a sense of humor.
They're both flounder?
They're both flounder? This one's tilapia, this one's sea bass. No, this is basa. This is basa. This one was sold as swai. Technically, it's a different species in the pangasis family. Okay? Let's be fair. In the interest of full disclosure, this isn't the Pangasis bacordi, it's the Pangasis, I forgot. But guess what? It's the same Japanese or Vietnamese catfish. Okay? That looks almost exactly the same as your flounder. And if I would have picked up this bag first or that bag first, you wouldn't have told the difference. And actually, was it flounder? Yeah, I think it was flounder. One of them was flounder. But you know what? I get told it looked like tilapia, it looked like sole, it looked like sea bass. Nobody knows. And there's people who know. Rybelski is very fond of telling over a story that he knows of a fish store that was regularly buying boxes of fish, taking it to the skinning operation behind the old Fulton Fish Market, drop a couple of cases of fish, and come pick it up in 2 hours. Okay, so what happens when he puts it by that door and comes back 2 hours later? All the skin has been removed. Now, she says, so what? Well, once the skin is removed, you just lost 100% of the Torah identification of the fish. Because when it still has at least a patch of skin on it, we could be some of that we can be potentially makir the fish based on a tefiyas ayin on the skin. Okay, Darkei Tshuva at the beginning of Pei Gimel discusses such a thing, that there's such a thing as a tefiyas ayin on the look of the skin, not the meat, but the skin. Why? Because you can recognize what fish it is by looking at a patch of skin. And I'll show you that we do this practically. We do this practically when something like this comes up. This is a package of tilapia. Well, when you look at this side, you're going to have to take my word on it that this is a tilapia. But you also have this side. And for those of you who are not otherwise familiar, this is this. Okay? Use your imagination. You can kind of see that happening? Okay? Okay, that should be... This used to look like this. Okay? How's that? A little better? Somebody said, tilapia is always blue. Wrong. The same farm could breed the same tilapia, some yellow, some white, some pink, some blue. It's amazing the difference in skin color between one tilapia and another on the same farm. And I saw pictures, Mashgiach took pictures for me, of tilapia from the same pen on the same farm that were all different colors. Now, why do I say farm? 85% of the tilapia you receive in the United States, farmed from China. FFC. Farmed from China. You hear? 85%. Who here heard of bad things coming out of China? Raise your hand.
Not macabre.
Well, for those of you who are worried about PCBs, lead, all kinds of other fun things coming out of your toys, your toothpaste, your cat food, your children's furniture, all things like that, your tilapia has an 85% chance of coming from
China.
Well, anyways, not to pick on Chinese too much, they do make delicious kosher tilapia too, with a patch of skin left on it. And based on this patch of skin, one could potentially come to be makir that this is in fact tilapia. And what will happen is like this. Let's say you're a food service guy, you're a restaurant, you're a hospital, you're a caterer. You can't start from scratch and do this all day long. If you had to start from this, it's going to take you a very long time to serve an entire hospital full of people. So you want to buy this. But there's a big mila of this too. This wasn't done with a mashgiach necessarily. Why? Because even if there was no mashgiach in the building when it was done, but they left you a patch of skin, so now you and I know what it is when we receive it, that we know this is tilapia. So this, I'm taking your word on it. Because what do I know? There's no way you could tell. No way you could tell. But this, I don't need your word, because I have the skin. But once the skin is removed, all bets are off. Okay? So again, when you want to go buy your kosher fish, you're going to buy it based on a list, let's say, right? So you the list said tilapia. So you walked in the store like an elegant fellow. You went to the guy behind the counter. Excuse me, can I please have tilapia? And he's looking behind the counter. And he's thinking, I don't need tilapia left. But I was looking at Seafood Business Magazine, and they recommended that you can't tell the difference between tilapia and catfish. Gotcha. And then he whips out the catfish, and now it won't look the same as quote unquote Hamish catfish tilapia. Why? Why is Hamish tilapia not? Does anyone notice that relative to this? It has a ruddy, reddish kind of color. Did anyone notice it's a little bit redder? Red, anyone?
Yes.
Please say yes, it's taking too long. Yes, it has a reddish color, Rabbi Goldberg. So observant of you. I'm colorblind, but I know it has a ruddier color. Why? Because they treat it with CO, carbon monoxide, to preserve it and keep it from spoiling so fast, even though mine were out of the refrigerator all day, and that's why they smell like this. Sorry, Rabbi Goldberg. But these fish... we're treated with carbon monoxide. It keeps them a little bit redder too. Because it seems that from people have an idea in their head that tilapia is supposed to have a vague resemblance to salmon. So they've been treating, and I heard this from a Hamish guy, he told me that when he sold tilapia, they make sure that they treat it with CO because the people that buy kosher tilapia expect it to have a shtickle reddish color. So it'll be a little bit redder than stem tilapia buy in the market.
I may have missed a lot of it, but as far as a chenvani, the mirtis issue is all gone with the FDA.
I wouldn't say it's all gone. But it's pretty much gone. There definitely could be circumstances where you could say that the guy might be afraid to do something or another. I wouldn't say I'll dismiss it, you know, carte blanche in every circumstance, but I would definitely say that the guy behind the counter, even if he's paid more than $7 an hour, which is not usually the case, is not somebody that you want to trust when it comes to what fish it is. Because all he knows is what tag it says on the display case. And that's not including that some fish could be known by multiple names. Some fish are known by multiple names. And I had one today where I had a lady professor from USC was asking me about a certain kind of cod and she was assuming cod is cod, and she was comparing polar cod to Arctic cod to standard cod, and I think polar cod is described as having embedded scales. Embedded is bad, because especially if they're subcutaneous embedded, or you know the subdermal embedded, that would mean that they're underneath the skin. So by definition, if it's underneath the skin, the only way to get to it is by ripping the skin. That's bad. So that's why if you'll find reference to, for instance, what are called eels. There's some eels that have scales. And people, yeah. So I opened up my Encyclopedia Britannica. It says fins and scales on eel. Where am I getting my eel? But those scales are usually embedded. I mean, as far as I've been able to find, any eel that had scales had embedded scales, subcutaneous, subdermal scales. So the only way to get to them, obviously, is by ripping the skin. That's a problem. Somebody asked about the barbuto. The Gemara talked about barbuto. It sounded like it had scales that were underneath the skin. There's a way to get them out. I don't know. We're not dealing with that. Okay. So you need to have a fish that has scales that can come out of the fish without ripping the skin. If the skin is removed, you're done. Because there's no way to know what it is. Because this could be the trout. What did I say this was?
Basa,
and this was the flounder, or maybe it was this was the swine, this was the flounder, and the good news is that it's rotten, so I don't plan on eating any of them, so take that concern right off. Especially I was trying to keep it straight which one was which, because I got them all confused myself, but not no gear. Okay, so you need to get a scale off of the fish, and then it's kosher. Okay, so now we get down to business. Okay, this is a tilapia. By the way, I shouldn't say all tilapia are from. This one is farm-raised from Ecuador. Okay, they by law, all fish have to have country of origin listing on them. It's called COOL regulation. Cool. No joke. They call it cool regulation. Country of origin labeling, and it was in order to protect other people that, you know, DAFCA wanted to buy American or something. So there is, by law, they have to report what country it comes from. So in this case, tilapia comes from Ecuador. So it is possible. But 85% chance, according to Seafood Business, 85% of the tilapia in the United States can try. Oh, so now, you go to find a scale on this fellow. So the guy at the fish store is laughing when I buy this, right? Because you're going to show them the scale. I scaled it already. But he was laughing, but I was laughing, because I checked it in the store and I found scales on it still. Yeah. See? Anybody watch what I'm doing? You go from the tail towards the head, okay? That's the tail and this is the head. In case anyone's confused. Okay. So you put your finger, remember I said three places, tail, backbone, and head. When the guy does the scaling, he never takes off every scale along the backbone, gills, and head, because the scaling knife, in order to get that last one that's all the way in the corner, you have to dig it in, and it's not worth it because everyone's going to cut that off anyways when they go to serve it, right? So they never bother. So he always laughs, and I'm never going to find a scale on it, and I know why I am going to find a scale, and I never gotten messed up yet. So anyway, so you check along the backbone, you see? You see that pop off? Here. So it's about half the size of a pinky. Okay. If anyone wants to pass it around, it's wrapped, and I don't recommend it.
I see along the whole side of the fish, those aren't scales?
Oh, that's what they call base moishav kaskasim, and there's some that would want to potentially be matter of fish based on base moishav kaskasim. It's a little bit dangerous to do that, because if you don't really know what you're doing, you might think it's base moishav kaskasim, but really it's embedded scales. And if you don't know the difference, you could get yourself in big trouble. Okay, rigor mortis set in. It's not going to go too far. Right. So basically, that's what you're going to do. You're going to go to a fish store anywhere on the face of planet Earth. And I watched a video of a guy who was doing shlichas for Chabadska, doing shlichas on in somewhere far east Asia, where they had not. There was nobody that remotely looked like him walking around the market, and there was no Empire Chicken even. You know, even if you want to be Macbeth on Empire, so there was nothing to talk about. There was no Empire Chicken in the supermarket either. So the fellow that was the outgoing took him to the supermarket to teach him which fish are which, so that he could see how to, you know, pick out which fish he was going to eat for the next, you know, how many years of his life that he was there, so he would know which fish he could eat, because the guy took him to the market and basically told him this one yeah, this one not, and he tried to get an idea in a sense, and he showed him how to, you know, do what I just did now, flick the back of the fish and pull out a scale. Here's a couple more. Yeah, he was sloppy today. Look at that. You see that? There's a whole kaburo scale right there. Here, see? Did you hear that noise, by the way? Now, I love to bring tilapia to these demonstrations because they have very big scales. It's very obvious when they're coming out. You can see the space where they are. And they're very large scales. I mean, I hold it up like this. You guys can see in the back room. Tilapia have stenoid scales. Stenoid comes from the Latin word for comb because they have little comb-like marks in the back of them. It's not for me. It's okay.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. So the comb-like part on the back side of the fish That's stenoid scales, as opposed to cycloid scales. Most kosher fish have either one or the other, but most of them have cycloid scales. And cycloid scales are perfectly round. Perfectly round. And actually, you can tell how old a fish is by counting its scales. Like the rings on the tree. No joke. But that's not true on gadoid scales and some of the other types of scales, placoid scales. The non-kosher types of scales, you can't, because those scales are really part of the body. They don't grow and develop rings as it goes along. Some of them fall out, get replaced. Some of them just grow along with the fish. Okay? That's what you would do if you'd want to check if a fish was kosher. Now, some people say, how big do the scales have to be? So that's why I like to bring a trout, because trout has very small scales. And the guy never bothers to scale the trout, because the scales of the trout are very soft, and they don't bother anybody. So even if you cook it with the scales still on, it doesn't chip anybody. So again, the same thing. You would kind of go like this, and I don't know if you see them kind of popping off this line over here. Now, somebody noticed me doing this once, and he saw that there was a spot that I ripped in the fish's skin. First of all, I argued, I don't think that's called ripping, and I spoke to Obelsky about this once before. Ripping really means, like, you know, serious damage kind of ripping. But also, if it ripped because you were rough with it, as opposed to because that's the only way to get a scale out, so obviously that didn't prove anything, right? So in this case, you know, I'm just trying to show you how the scales literally fly when you scratch like this along the back of the fish. So you're always going to start from the tail end, go towards the head end. Somebody asked me once, how do I know? Maybe there's some fish that's the other way around, right? Maybe the fish, you know, have scales kind of like this. So you're laughing, right? Oh, it swims that way. So my grandfather, Shalom, told me a mice that when he was in Germany, that somebody designed a car that was much more ergonomically designed when it comes to the driver getting in. And if you ever think about this, if you're the driver in a car, right, you're going to open the door with your left hand usually, swing it across your body, turn around, and rotate your body in order to get in. That's kind of stupid. Wouldn't it make much more sense to stand a draft more like this, open with your right hand, pull the door, and it swings fully past you, and you go straight in? Makes a lot of sense, right? This is what happens when academics get anywhere near a production line. So a guy designed a car like this, made perfect sense. So he designed it, they went to test drive it, and they had a very big problem. After a few, you know, they started picking up speed a little bit, the door flew off the hinge and to the back of the Autobahn. Why? Because the pressure from the wind going against the car yanked the door right there off the hinge and right out the door. So for a fish, the exact same thing would happen as it's swimming through the ocean like this. If the scales were this way, the pressure of the water would yank the scales off, clean it. The fish need their scales intact to prevent against bacteria, parasites, predators, all kinds of things. You'll often find, if you go fishing especially, that there's a layer of mucus that covers the length of a fish. Some people get turned off and they think that means it's a trafe. Because they went to touch it, they didn't find a scale on it, it was all mushy and slimy, and gazagas, and they had enough of it. But it happens to be that slime is another protective layer, just like you have mucus in your body where you need to protect stuff. So the fish has a mucus that covers the scales. Most fish have a mucus layer, and they call it slime. That's actually the term. And when they refer to it, I'm serious. And when they refer to it in a fish factory, that they would slime the fish or de-slime the fish in order to, you know, it's one step in processing. That typically when they'll get it, they'll wash it off or they'll put some kind of enzyme in it to remove that slime along the top. If you go fishing and the fish is slimy, don't get turned off right away. Gotta, you know, kind of clear off a spot and see if there's something, you know, underneath. Okay? So far, so good. I'm going to quickly talk about salmon, then we'll take questions. Okay, so the rule is that if the skin is removed, you have no idea what it is. Even if you think you know what it is, you don't know what it is. Oh, I forgot. I was in the middle of Rebelsky's story. I'm sorry. So Rebelsky had this story. So he had a bunch of guys that were taking their fish to the fish market and having a guy skin them, comes back 2 hours later. Problem is, he just left Kirvei Dagim behind. Because Pagimel Siv Zion, Kirvei Dagim are Osir. Literally means fish guts, but it means any unidentifiable part of the fish. If you can't identify it anymore, it's effectively fish guts, because you have no idea what it is. And the din is, you're only allowed to buy them from certain kinds of people that we know that he's selling the right kind of stuff. So this fellow told Rebelsky, what are you bothering me for? I know what a fish is supposed to look like even when the skin is removed. So Rebelsky said, would you be willing to put it to a test? And the fellow said, of course. So Rebelsky got another fish monitor to set it up for him in an office, and he put all, you know, a bunch of different kinds of fish. Okay, which one's the sole? And the guy said, oh, posh it. And he picked the catfish. So Rebelsky said, thank you very much, Tiskel Mitzvah. And he had a beautiful mindset, and he never tires from saying it over. So the bottom line is, even if you think you know, and you've been a fish guy for 20 years, you don't know, and it's not so simple. And even if you thought my comparison between the flounder and the swai wasn't so good, between catfish and tilapia, definitely has a resemblance, and like I said, Seafood Business Magazine mentioned a few times, I saw it, that when you don't have one, you can always substitute for the other. And they were recommending this to professional sellers. Not illegally. No, no, I mean, they were saying, you know, to recommend to somebody, you know, when you're trying to push a product, right? So you're in the South, and people know from catfish, they don't know from tilapia. So you sell it to them by explaining to them that catfish tastes a lot like tilapia, and vice versa. Okay. So when you take the skin off, all bets are off, you have no idea what it is anymore, and now it's awesome. That's the rule, and the exception is going to be salmon. What? Salmon, the Orthodox Union and many of our friends hold, that the red color of the salmon is a simen muvuk, that this is a salmon. Okay? Now, many have asked the following question. Oh, so not just salmon, by the way. There's red trout, steelhead. There's certain kinds of other red trout that look very similar to salmon. They're the exact same mishpacha. Carp is in the same mishpacha. Believe it or not, whitefish is in the same mishpacha as salmon, big family. And theoretically, any of those fish with red flesh, we have yet to find a red flesh fish which is not kosher. And this isn't our thing that we made up on our own. Rebelsky said that he heard this from Ramesh Zatzal, and it was not written in any of the Mishpacha that I know of. As I understand, it was a Shiloh that Nutter Greenblatt had asked, and Rebelsky was present. If I remember correctly, he was present at the time when the question was being asked, and Ramesh said it was the Rapashit. That it's a simen muvuk, the red color of this, until you'll find that there's such a thing as a fish with red flesh that's not kosher, so then you have what to be worried about. But until then, we know pretty much everything that's there in the world, and there's no such thing as a red flesh fish that's not kosher. Somebody started hacking us once about something called salmon shark. It's popular in France. You can actually get it in Bushwick too, I understand. And it's a very expensive shark, or relatively expensive to the shark family, and it has a reddish color. The reddish color on this salmon shark is shvach. When real shark is very white. So relative to real shark, yeah, it's significantly red, but you know, if you compare that to a salmon, you're not going to get confused even a drop. And that's not including the shape of the muscle, which some people also want to consider as a simen muvuk, that the grain in the muscle is something that you'd be able to tell right away. Now, the question is, farm salmon are fed colors. So people say, oh, farm salmon are fed colors. Why? Because when you don't feed farm salmon colors, their flesh is about as gray as a, whatever it is, flounder or whatever we're calling it today. So in order to get the farm salmon to have the same red color as wild salmon, they feed it carotenoids, specifically astaxanthin and canaxanthin, although there is some zeaxanthin and one other carotenoid that you can sometimes find in salmon feed. So they feed it these vitamins. Now, you can imagine that it's not like, you know, Flintstones chewables, that, you know, you grab each fish and, you know, you convince them to go, you know, chew this up, right? They mix it with the feed, and it's part of the regular feed of the salmon. It's an antioxidant, it kills free radicals, yada, 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 but it also turns the fish red. Now, somebody say like this, oy goes oy. You found the vitamin that turns flesh red, so the whole red fish rule goes out the door, because now you can feed anything this red vitamin and it'll turn the flesh red. To which, in 2006, I sat with a researcher that the OU had hired at the time for the summer, and we wrote a two-part article for Hamadiyah explaining why that's not true, pun of Acher. First of all, as far as biology is concerned, the carotenoids that salmon are fed are not a dye, it's not a pigment, it's not an FDNC food color or anything else like that. It's a carotenoid, it's like beta-carotene, it's a naturally occurring antioxidant, and this carotenoid is metabolized differently by every single creature. Okay? For example, koi are fed carotenoids, those of you who are into raising decorative fish. So the koi in the park are always fed carotenoids because it brings out the color of their skin. Not their flesh, but their skin. Birds are fed carotenoids, it makes their feathers very bright. You know those African macaws over there? Okay. Humans even consume carotenoids, specifically canaxanthin, and you'll find it on the internet as an artificial tanning drug. It won't be called an artificial tanning drug. It'll be called a skin supplement, but you'll see pictures of beautifully bronze-skinned people. Now, why would they do that, Rabbi Goldberg? Well, because humans metabolize their carotenoids in two places. One is the retina of the eye, which is why the EU regulates how much carotenoid a salmon farmer can put in his fish, because they're afraid that, you know, some European is going to eat too much fish and he's going to wind up going blind from carotenoids stored in his retina. So the EU regulates a certain parts per million they're allowed to put in the fish. Fine. The other place you metabolize it is in your skin. So when you eat lots and lots of carotenoids, right, it turns your skin orange. Some people somehow think this orange looks tan. It doesn't to me, not even in the picture on the internet, but some people think it does. A few years ago, there was a girl in England who ate too many carrots and her skin turned orange. But amazingly, no one thought she was a salmon. Because just because something managed to metabolize a red color and turn epistichical orange's color didn't make it look like salmon at all. Her parents even called her by name afterwards. I understand. So that was as far as that was concerned. They did experiments on other fish, trying to feed this carotenoid to other fish, and guess what happened? Much of nothing. Why? Because everything metabolizes its carotenoids differently and stores it differently. Members of the salmonid family happen to metabolize their carotenoids by storing it in the flesh, which is what turns their flesh red and not their skin red. Even though when humans would eat it, it would turn their skin orangish kind of red. Okay? So in theory, if there would be a fish that they would find that was farmed that could be fed carotenoid and metabolized into the flesh, that would be a problem. Except, of course, we checked with the experts, the people who both manufacture the carotenoids, the farmers, and the scientists that deal with the stuff, and everyone was masking that there is no such thing as a non-salmonid fish which metabolizes carotenoids into the flesh. So much for that theory. Now, of course, there's got to be a researcher in Eretz Yisrael who is in one of the local colleges and universities in Eretz Yisrael who knows that he's right and I'm wrong, and in fact, he could turn catfish red. And he claimed that he had a study that he proved that you could turn that catfish can eventually be metabolizing their carotenoids like salmon does. Here's what he claims. Now, we went back to the researcher that was originally masked as the world expert in, I think it was Norway. And we asked him, so he said, well, if you look at the guy's research, what he claims is it was significantly redder. He refused to include any kind of pictures. He refused to define what level of significantly redder it was. But in his mind, it was significantly redder, and that was all the peer review he needed in order to make the statement that you could turn tilapia, or for that matter, catfish, into salmon by feeding it carotenoids. He also didn't discuss the level of carotenoids you have to feed it in order to potentially make that happen. And I guess if you overdose anything with ridiculous amounts of it, you might be able to get some kind of effect. But even he had to be masking in the end. It wasn't going to be red like salmon. It was going to be red like from tilapia. Give or take. That was that. But Rabbi Goldberg, there's lots of other ways to skin a fish. You could also take red food coloring and inject it directly into the fish, which is when you people who buy cheap smoked salmon, when you'll notice in the back of the package that it says red number 40 and red and other red colors, what they did was, no, this is real true, what they do is they take off-colored fish, both wild Alaskan salmon and actually farmed Chilean salmon that are off-color, and they'll inject it with red food coloring as part of the brining process, and they'll turn it into a red color which you would never believe was red. Because if you actually thought that God made something that color, you have issues. But I don't know why they insist on doing this, and I even asked the guy in the factory once, what are you picking such a neon orangish kind of color? May it at least look something close. That's what people expect it to look like, right? Like, Goldberg, that's what we produce. Okay. But theoretically, they could take it and turn it into a normal color red. So how do I know that plain raw salmon isn't dyed with artificial food coloring? Okay. So two things. First of all, in order to do that, you need to do a two-part process in order to make an even color. You need to inject with a brine, and you need to stick in a cover brine. Okay? That's the two-part process that the smoked salmon guys do in order to get their fish red. In order to get the red food coloring to bind to the proteins of the fish, you have to mix it with a salt. You see where I'm going with this? When you're making smoked salmon and it's sitting in a significant amount of sodium chloride, you found the salt, which is able to bind with the protein to the color, right? But if you're trying to make something and pass it off as plain raw salmon, and you inject the amount of salt that one would find in smoked salmon, what do you think the consumer would think when he took a bite of that sucker? Ugh. Good answer. You would taste it and he'd be like, this is ridiculous, it tastes like smoked salmon, it's like ridiculously salty, right? So in theory it's possible. It's hard to believe that you wouldn't notice the color injection because, first of all, the fat lines, when you inject it, will get less clear. They'll get muddled a little bit because the idea is to have the color dissipate throughout the flesh. I have seen some better coloring jobs where you didn't see the fat lines get messed up, so I'm not going to quote that as an absolute. But one thing we can say is an absolute, and I checked this out on both coasts, guys who do it in New York and guys who do it in Seattle, everyone agreed there's no way to get the protein to bind to the color or the color to bind to the protein without adding salt. So if you were fishing that someone skinned your salmon and stuck, made something else and figured out a fish that was white, that looked just like salmon, was trafe, and injected it with something in order to turn it red, it would be very salty. So if you find something that was skinless salmon and it was ridiculously salty, so then you should go back to the store and ask the guy what he injected it with in order to turn it into salmon. Okay. 3 minutes for questions. Go. Yeah.
What's the issue with sort of with regards to tuna and dolphins?
There's no dolphins in tuna. The dolphin safe regulation, if you look it up online, which I did, Code of Federal Regulations explained, the dolphin safe term that you find on tuna refers to the process of injuring or killing a dolphin in the process of fishing for tuna. What the fishermen found out was that when you're looking for fish, where do you go? So if you have sonar in your boat, so you train the sonar in order to go find the fish. But there's a much easier way than training the sonar to find a tuna, which might be this big or might be huge. You could train it to go for a dolphin, which is definitely huge. It's easy to find dolphin. Dolphin feed on tuna. So if you set your sonar on the dolphin, then you'll know that there'll be tuna underneath. So you set your nets underneath the dolphin, catch the tuna that he was feasting on, and in the process, you chop the dolphin. The nets are set up in a way that the dolphin's supposed to be escaping, okay? Because they don't want the dolphin. It doesn't benefit the tuna process at all. But sometimes you get a stupid dolphin that doesn't know he's supposed to leave now. Or he's just interested in his lunch and he doesn't want to leave. So those dolphins got injured or killed. The dolphin lobby decided that this is a problem, and they don't want to see dead dolphins, so they lobbied Congress to make a rule that you can't kill dolphins. They couldn't say you can't kill dolphins because the tuna guys went back to court and said, but we have to fish, and what are we supposed to do? So they made a thing called Dolphin Safe. So in order to put the Dolphin Safe seal on your tuna, some do and some don't, you have to certify, you have to have Mashgiach Tamidi paid for by you, a government Mashgiach Tamidi, not Jewish obviously, supervising, I'm not fair. I mean, I guess it could be Jewish, but it's not, it's not, it's not, somebody from the government, representing the government, who's there watching every single catch. The captain of the ship has to document which FAO area he captured the fish in and keep it in separate holds of the boat and document which ones were dolphin safe and which ones were not. And that goes through on the paperwork. When they sell it to the next guy, to the next guy, to the next guy, they have to tell them that it was dolphin safe or not. No dolphin ever came into a tuna factory. No dolphin ever wound up in a tuna can. The reason why you were led to believe that is because the environmentalists didn't want to just say dolphins are getting killed. Because that's bad enough. But it's one thing to tell people that you're killing Flipper. It's another people to tell them you are eating Flipper. So they wanted you to try to think that, you know, you're eating the dolphin. Because that freaked people out much more than the idea that the dolphin is dying. I don't care about the dolphins. I care about the fish inside the can. But if they tell you you're eating dolphin, you don't eat dolphin. So then they got people to be much more worried about it. Nobody has ever claimed to have found a dolphin in a tuna factory. And it's actually pretty ludicrous. I myself have gone to Colombia and Trinidad to local tuna factories to watch how it's done. And the process, how they document every single fish. I was looking at albacores, they're much significantly larger fish. They tag every single fish on its tail, where it came from, the boat, and everything else. The boat gets paid by the factory based on the quality of the fish they bring in. So if they bring in a dolphin, that gets rejected right away, and the factory is not going to pay. So it's not like the factory is, ooh, I mean, the rabbi's not looking, I'm going to go grab the dolphin. Well, no, there's no point. Why just don't pay for it? So there's never been a dolphin in a factory. We don't have Mashgiach Tamidi in every tuna factory, as you may have known already, because we go through the process, we know what tuna factories do and don't process and how they process. Vloyoid, there's never been a trade fish in a tuna factory. There's never been a non-tuna in a tuna factory. And when a tuna factory is processing albacore, you'll never find skipjack. Skipjack, you'll never find yellowfin. Yellowfin, you'll never find big eye, because each one of those fish has a different time and temperature on its retort configuration. Those cans that you buy, cans of tuna, they have to be stuck in a retort oven, which cooks the fish inside the can. Each species cooks differently at a different rate. So they have different code set up on the retort. The retort operator is a guy, probably the best paid guy in the building, and he has to actually have, I think, a master's or a doctor in, you know, these kind of engineering technology. You could kill people. You don't hire some guy for $8 an hour and hope for the best. You want to make sure that the guy who's doing this is going to make sure not to kill you and put you out of business. So the retort operator has to know exactly what's inside. They'll never mix big cans with small cans in the same retort. They'll never mix two species in the same retort. Because if they did, they would have to, you know, the cook temperature would be good for one and not good for the other, and somebody could die. It's not the fish that are cooked. Tuna are always pre-cooked, except for certain gourmet tunas. Tuna are always pre-cooked in a steam oven, whole. The whole fish are rolled into an oven. They're filled with a box of steam. We hold the Kitur is Labitan Bishel. There's all other Akhranim hold that Kitur is Labitan Bishel. There are Akhranim who disagree, hold that Kitur is Mitan Bishel. That would be a problem, but... We don't think so. Listen, you know, the standard of what's called the king's table has changed so much. Some people think that cereal has to be all Shulchan Malachim, so don't ask me. Okay, so that was your question about tuna. Next. Yes?
Can you buy salmon, let's say, in a Pathmark?
Not only that, you can really buy kosher fish in any supermarket that you want to do this. Once you check that it had kosher simonim, you made sure the guy washed the knife, covered the board that he's going to cut it on, and you supervise the fish from the time he removes the skin, he could cut it for you, you take it home and enjoy. Now, what if he cuts it already or it's pre-cut? Assuming the skin is intact and you're able to identify what species it is, you could clean it up at home by taking the fish and being mavir nolov b'chudah shel sak in the Pesach Tshuva at the end of Tzadi Vav. Talk about this thing. You do shif shif. You know, you run it under. You wash it and you scrape it with it. You scrape it with a scrub brush. Or you take a knife and you scratch over it. You do not need a kidei klipa. You do not need a kidei nechila. You don't need to kiss it to God or anything else like that. Just maver ol b'kuba chudash al sakin. Takes off whatever shamnunas may have landed on the fish, and that cleans it up. Even if the guy didn't wash his knife beforehand, please do not throw away fish because the guy touched it with a trafe knife or like this one. I had one. Somebody called me up. She bought the fish, but it was gutted already. So it was gutted. So she didn't want to. She was afraid. What if you used the trafe knife to gut it? So again, you'd be maver ol b'chudash al sakin on this part only. That's the only part that he actually cut, and you'd be good to go. Yes?
You were talking about different types of tuna. Are those types of tuna all used as sushi?
Okay, usually sushi is made from ahi, but I can't tell you it always is. Interestingly enough, the tuna factories usually cut out the red meat and throw it to the cat food production, because nobody wants red meat in their can of tuna. But somehow, when they go to make sushi, everybody wants the red meat. So they get belly cuts of meat from the tuna. I can't tell you that all the red meat in the tuna is coming from a kosher species of tuna. Can't tell you that. What I can tell you is that if you buy sushi at a non-kosher restaurant, you're going to have a problem. First of all, you have a problem with the fish, because you don't know if the fish is kosher fish. So the guy, somebody told me, what if it was salmon? Okay, it's still going to be also for a different reason, because it's usually marinated. And the stuff they marinate in is often wine vinegar. So you got to take the fish and throw it out. Same thing with the vegetables, because the vegetables are usually also marinated in the same wine vinegar. Okay, so you bought trace sushi, you threw away the fish, you threw away the vegetables. The rice is also because of bishalakum. You have to throw away the rice also. The nori is a problem because the nori has seahorses and shrimp that are caught in the seaweed while it's growing. Kosher nori is supposed to be checked by a mashgiach before they shred it. They don't take nori and just take it out of the sea and stick it in a box. They shred it into like molds, like paper, yeah? And then they put it in press, and they press it out of the process. It looks like mamish like paper. Well, once it's shredded and turned into paper, you're not going to be able to see much, except for every so often you get a seahorse like this. You know, smashed from inside. No, somebody told me that the way they originally found it, Chavraman was checking nori, he was looking through it, and he saw a seahorse against the side of a piece of nori. So he's like, boy, that's, you know what that is. So they went down to the factory where they were making the mulch, and they saw it. Because, you know, the little seahorses, you know, you got a piece of seaweed growing from the, you know, like this in the bottom of the sea. So there's a little tiny seahorse like this, or a shrimp or something. You know, the little gets caught in there, trying to hide to, you know, protect himself from predators. So, and then some Jew comes by, grabs the little thing, chops it off, and, you know, like, grinds it all up, and he's stuck. So the kosher nori has to be checked for bugs before it's shredded. Once you turn it into nori, it's too late. So you're going to have to toss the nori too. So, if you bought trace sushi and you threw away the fish, the vegetables, the rice, and the nori, you could eat the plate after you wash it, because it had trace sushi on it. So you're going to have to wash the tray before you eat that.
Salmon from Costco.
Costco salmon? Kosher for Passover. Enjoy it. Without an OU on it.
Without a skin.
Without a skin, yes.
Why do some people why are there a number of hashkafas that will not accept OU tuna fish and similar tuna fish?
Because they're wrong. You got that?
What's the
we don't require hashkafa to mean this. They do. Rebelski is very much of the opinion that there should be hashkafa to mean this by all fish products. He's very much of that opinion. Rav Schechter is very much not of that opinion. And the OU has always accepted the opinion of Rav Schechter, which was based on the Rav. There's a Tosfos Arid that's quoted actually. Tosfos Arid is quoted by the Shiboli Alekhet, quotes the Tosfos Arid, and you find it in the Tur and Pei Gimel. If you have the old pages of the Tur, if you old Tur, everybody's laughing. What old Tur? There is no such thing as an old Tur. If you had the old Tur, it's on the Amud Beis, mamash in the middle of a page. It's because of Shiboli Alekhet, it's the Divrei Master. But the new Tur is on your own. But anyway, so he quotes such a thing that they always took Tunina without Ashgacha. And Rav Soloveitchik had an explanation that they had chazakas, and they created certain chazakas in their time, meaning the Rid's time, about why they were willing to accept Tunina without Stim and Reish V'Shedra. So we asked before about Reish V'Shedra. You're right. So they even accepted without Stim and Reish V'Shedra because of a chazaka they had that they knew that the Tunina processors were making nothing but tuna. Then, of course, the recent Achronim have a big question if Tunina is Takatuna or not, and if it's just Truva or not. But Rav Soloveitchik said it doesn't really matter because the bottom line is we can only imagine the worst case scenario of how they were willing to accept the tunina without any simonim on it. And what we would imagine is that they knew where the fish was being processed. They knew which fish were available over there. Must be that the factory, for Tanei Mischa reasons, not because of Hashkacha reasons, was makbid to only use that species of tunina. And they had a regular inspection. Some yid went to check up regularly to make sure it was there. So he said, listen, that's the worst case scenario. It could be that they were much more mako than us. Could be that they were much more mako. Could be that they went, they saw there was nothing but tunina there, and they called it a day. They knew that it was nothing but tunina. But we're taking the worst case scenario to imagine what could they have done to make the statement that there's a chazaka that it's nothing but tunina. And we multiply that, we copy that throughout our tuna and other fish processing facilities. Other people feel that we shouldn't be samach on that, that the Gemara seems to say that you need to have two simonim whenever you buy fish, and if you'll go buy fish, and I know your factory will make fish without seals on it, so how will you know what kosher species it is? So we think that the answer to that is the same way you know what every other factory is producing, the same systems that we have in every kind of potato chip, pretzels, cookies, canned corn factory, we'll set up those systems in a fish factory and we'll call it the same thing. It's machlokas in policy and whether you need hashgacha tuminos or not. But once again, no one has ever found a dolphin hanging out anywhere near a tuna facility.
OUP tuna,
if you'll find it, except for the Hamish brands, I don't believe there's any done anymore, but OUP tuna is done with hashgacha tuminos in Bishra Yisrael. Because if we're there anyway, is to give hashgacha tuminos for Pesach, so we make a Bishra Yisrael, you know, for the people that are mafra and Bishra Yisrael and hashgacha tuminos.
Still issues with casein aid?
Not anymore. If you find any OUD tuna, you better throw it out. And that was from Bumblebee. I asked them about that once. Somebody went to one of these 99-cent stores, and they were selling some closeout stuff. And the guy said the last one they made that he remembers was 1985. So it's way past the... Tuna will last a while. I think the official life is 4 years because it has oil in it usually. But you will not find any milk tuna anymore.